have to throw in a historical tidbit here that Harriet Island in St. Paul is, of course, named after Harriet Bishop. And it is, I think, a reflection upon the dignity with which we have customarily accorded women, that the island is known by the first name rather than the last name of the individual. It's my pleasure now to introduce to you Betty Howard.
Good evening, sisters. I'm pleased to be here this evening to take part in this discussion on women in public education in Minnesota. As you can see from your program, I am to discuss affirmative action and sex bias programs in our public schools. Before I deal with what I would term solutions, or at least attempted solutions to sex discrimination in education, I'd like to touch on the conditions existing in public education that make affirmative action and sex bias programs necessary. But first of all, I'd like to define some of the words and phrases that I'll be using. I've taken these definitions from the report of the Sex Bias Task Force, which you'll hear about later. First of all, feminism. This is a theory that women should have political, economic, and social rights equal to those of men. The movement to win such rights for women. Feminist, an advocate or supporter of feminism. Sexism, the belief in the inferiority of one sex to another. Sexism is also the process whereby patriarchal attitudes and behaviors are institutionalized, permeating the whole society via language, history, laws, religion, politics, education, economics, and psychology. I have to tell you a little bit about the word sexism. When we first started discussing it with the State Board of Education Subcommittee on Sex Discrimination, there was a great deal of concern. This was back in the early 70s. There was a great deal of concern and a great deal of fear that the term sexism would be confused with sex education. And there has been this fear. And if you'll notice, when the State Department of Education has set up task force or advisory committees, it never rarely uses the term sexism, which of course is the counterpart to racism. It always says sex bias, which they feel is just a little bit safer. Sexist, this is a person who believes and practices sexism. Sex discrimination or sex bias, practices of law, custom, or habit which oppress one sex, prejudice based solely on sex, exclusive of individual characteristics. Affirmative action, a positive program designed to increase opportunities for women, minorities, and other underrepresented groups. Sex role stereotyping, the process by which the sexes are socialized into so-called feminine and masculine behaviors and predetermined roles which are accepted as natural. I became aware of sex discrimination in Minnesota public schools back in 1967 when I was a field representative for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, investigating cases of discrimination based on race, color, religion, or national origin. A young man sought our help when he was denied a position as a first grade teacher solely because of his sex. That's a woman's job, he was told. The raised eyebrows, the critical reaction to his interest in teaching primary grades, were most eloquent in communicating the attitude of the superintendent toward any man who would want an elementary teaching job. Men taught social studies, math, and they coached football. Women taught kindergarten and the primary grades. Now, sex was not a prohibited basis for discrimination in employment in this state in 1967, and there was no redress available to that young man. 8 years ago, sex role stereotyping was the norm. There were men's jobs and there were women's jobs in our educational system, as well as in the larger society. If you were a teacher, gender determined the grades you taught, often the salary you earned, your fringe benefits. Need we mention what sex profited from that system? Student life, too, was tracked by gender. Today, it's almost redundant to enumerate the countless ways in which students' educational experiences were, and unfortunately, in many instances still are, determined by sex. Athletic opportunities, class selection, career counseling, to name only a few. It's not my task here tonight to analyze the psychological, emotional, sociological, and historical reasons for this condition, nor to debate its beneficial or harmful effects. For our purposes, I simply present the facts, as most of us today recognize them to be. The case of the young man who wanted to teach first grade was, of course, atypical. As I've pointed out, most often it is women who were and are victimized not only by being denied job opportunities, but by countless other practices and policies which communicated their message to all females. Your anatomy determines your destiny. It was in the late 60s, you will recall, that the Kerner Commission report was published, shocking the entire nation by labeling American society racist. For the first time, we were challenged to acknowledge not only our individual racism, but the institutionalized racism that permeated our schools, our banks, our political parties, our government, our communities, our social relationships. Right on the heels of that revelation came further accusations from an even larger segment of the population than the minorities. Women, too, were second-class citizens. Time and again throughout the history of this nation, a strong surge for women's rights has followed on the heels of a strong push for minority rights. Women struggling for equality for oppressed racial minorities suddenly realize that they too are an oppressed group. Strong manifestations of this new awareness suddenly appeared in feminist circles in Minnesota. In 1971, a small group of us prevailed on the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to ask the legislature to include sex in all of its provisions. That is the State Act Against Discrimination's provisions. Discrimination in employment on the basis of sex had been added to the law in 1969. Now we sought to have sex discrimination in housing, public accommodations, public services, and education prohibited. The bill was laughed out of subcommittee in the legislature, and we had to wait another 2 years to prevail. However, we did not wait 2 years to call for reform of public education. In 1971, the Women's Advisory Committee to the Department of Human Rights organized a subcommittee on sexual stereotypes in education. And in September of 1972, this subcommittee succeeded in getting the State Board of Education to issue this pamphlet. It's called Eliminating Sex Bias in Education. And it's a statement of policy and proposed action. The board distributed it to the 438 school districts in Minnesota. It is a proposal for affirmative action to provide equal opportunity for women and to eliminate sex bias practices in our educational system. It emphasizes four areas of concern. discrimination in hiring and promotion, sex requirements for boys and girls to participate in sports and extracurricular activities, sex bias in curricular and teaching materials, and providing in-service training for administrators and teachers to overcome the habits and practices of teaching stereotyped social roles. It's a beautiful document, and I have copies here for anyone who would like more to look at it more specifically. A beautiful document, and it was distributed throughout Minnesota 3 years ago. And as far as we interested in its implementation can discern, it was promptly relegated to the round file. Presidential Order 11246, as amended by Order 11375, requires all recipients of federal government contracts of $10,000 or more to adopt an affirmative action plan. Now, this would include most schools. But to date, there has been little or no enforcement of this requirement for schools. Interested citizens, however, finally prevailed upon the State Board of Education to move toward implementation of this excellent policy. And it really is. It is a good policy. In January of 1974, a sex bias task force was appointed by the Commissioner of Education to develop guidelines for implementation of the policy. And in an astonishingly brief time, the task force, by really Herculean effort, submitted this report. 100 pages of the, it's a complete analysis of the problems of sex bias in our educational system. And it contains 28 recommendations for its elimination, that is, for the elimination of sex bias. It's another beautiful document. A comprehensive blueprint for affirmative action for schools. It's a little heavy for relegation to the round file. More likely, it has found its place at the bottom of the needs immediate attention pile on most school administrators' desk. As for the State Board of Education action on this report, as far as I have been able to discover, the board has to date acted upon some of the recommendations as follows. It has revised its own affirmative action plan and moved toward compliance in its own employment patterns. It has disseminated information about sex discrimination laws and regulations to all the school districts. It has appointed a sex bias advisory committee, which will be meeting for the first time on October 27th of 1975, only 6 months after, what, a year, 18 months after it was first recommended that it be established. It now does require, that is the State Board, does require each school district to file an athletic reporting form each year along with other required reports. And this asks for detailed information about athletics, including budget, participation, and opportunities by sex, and it's good. Sexism has been integrated into the intercultural programs. The Department of Education has presented several programs on sex bias for State Department of Education personnel, and it has presented workshops and programs for educational and community groups. It has adopted regulations banning separation of classes by sex and is currently preparing regulations which will prohibit discriminatory practices in education by defining the duties of the school boards and the Commissioner of Education in this regard. And that is a real accomplishment. If the State Board actually does adopt them, it will be on the agenda for the November or the December State Board meetings. But from the point of view of feminist activists, this is not a very satisfactory progress report. But when compared to the speed of implementation of comparable guidelines, say at the federal level, it rates fairly high. After all, guidelines for Title IX of the Educational Amendments of 1972 were approved by Congress and signed by the President in July of 1975. 3 years seems to be standard. So far, we have limited our discussion to the role of the State Board of Education. Although the State Board has the greatest potential for exercising its clout for achieving equality in education, it by no means provides the only route for eliminating sex discrimination in the schools. On the federal level, there are at least 6 applicable laws and executive orders concerning sex discrimination in education. And I'll run through them very quickly. If you are interested in them, I'll be glad to answer questions afterward. But I'm just going to enumerate them for you very quickly now. Executive Order 11246, as amended by 11375, Revised Order 4, and Revised Order Number 14, all ban discrimination on the basis of sex in employment in the schools by recipients of federal contracts of $10,000 or over, and they provide for affirmative action plans and compliance reviews. There is the Equal Pay Act of 1963, as amended in 1972 to apply to teachers, and Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, also amended in 1972 to apply to teachers. There's Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 and Title VII of the Public Health Service Act. These last two prohibit discrimination against students and others in admissions and opportunities on the part of educational institutions. The Women's Educational Equality Act, sponsored by Senator Mondale, by the way, and passed just recently, provides grants from HEW for development of non-sexist curriculum and tests, non-discriminatory vocational and career counseling, sports education, and other programs designed to achieve educational equity. Adequately enforced, of course, these laws could produce a society totally free of sexism. Of course, it goes without saying that they're not adequately enforced. In fact, some of them are hardly enforced at all. That statement does not apply, however, to two of the laws, and that is the Equal Pay Act and Title VII. Those are enforced fairly effectively. The State Human Rights Act also bans, amongst other prohibitions, discrimination on the basis of sex in employment and in admission to and utilization of the benefits of educational institutions. Another law, which if adequately enforced, would create a feminist utopia. There are similar local laws in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. By this point in time, I think we all recognize that laws, while vital to creating societal changes, can never succeed unless the attitudes of the people are in agreement with their basic philosophy. Now, many of the state programs on sex bias are based on this concept, that is the attempt to change the attitudes, and they are aimed at attitudinal change. Now, many schools have appointed task force on sexism. I myself have served on 2 in addition to the state group. Usually the format of this group is to define the problem, set the goals, and devise procedures for achieving those goals, many times resulting in the development of affirmative action plans, as happened in Minneapolis and in Edina. A few school districts have already adopted affirmative action plans, and St. Paul is one, and Minnetonka, another. Anoka and Minneapolis and Bloomington are currently considering their affirmative action plans. Some school districts have hired affirmative action officers and specialists in sexism. Some have women's studies divisions. Many have classes on feminism and women's history. Many libraries have good resource material prominently displayed and easily accessible. And women's organizations such as the League of Women Voters and the AAUW present seminars on women's concerns to educate their communities. Many school districts include women's issues in their professional growth courses, and all human relations courses now include units on sexism along with those on race. Minnesotans have produced source material. For example, the Edmund Willard Task Force's book on sexism in schools and Nina Rothschild's handbook on school boards and sexism. Bookstores such as Learn Me, just around the corner from you, provide non-sexist materials. The most heavily funded federal program on combating sexism in public schools is being conducted in St. Cloud. The St. Cloud State University Human Relations Office received a $191,746 grant for a year-long program concentrating on St. Cloud Technical High School. The program involves a group of 100 people, including 10 high school students, 37 school teachers, 10 parents, and 16 top school administrators and counselors, who are paid $6 an hour for participating in the program. When I think of what that sex bias task force did for nothing. Hours and hours and hours of very dedicated work. Some of its goals are to discover which school district policies have a sexist impact, to revise courses and teaching methods in a non-sexist direction, and to change enrollment patterns and encourage student examination of their own attitudes toward sex roles. The staff of the project advises school officials on a day-to-day basis regarding activities and policies in the school. The St. Cloud grant reinforces Minnesota's posture as a national leader in civil rights and a proponent for equality for women. But it's still true that we have few women administrators in the public school systems. Only one woman superintendent in the entire state. Sports budgets are still 10 times as high for boys as they are for girls. Some schools think they are complying with state board regulations regarding integrated home economic and industrial arts classes when they offer gourmet cooking for boys and woodworking for girls. That's integration. However, on balance, Minnesota's programs on sex bias in the public schools do rank among the best in the country. What we who care need to do now is to continue to press for better implementation. We, the citizens of Minnesota, can have non-sexist public education when we decide we want our children to be free to choose their own roles in life without the impact of sexist stereotyping and are willing to work toward that end.
Could we stand up for a few minutes and exercise? And then afterwards we'll have questions from the panel or to the panel.